Welcome back to another episode of LSHTM Viral and the final in our season on planetary health. For those of you who didn't get a chance to get one of our WHO-approved LSHTM face masks, I am pleased to say that they are back in stock, alongside our hoodie featuring an illustrated baobab tree by renowned tattoo artist Rebecca Vincent, and our new t-shirt. All proceeds go directly to funding our COVID-19 research. Visit giftstore.lshtm.ac.uk to get your merch. So, welcome back, Amy and Carl. How are you doing today, Carl?
I'm doing very well. It's nice to be back and listening to you all again.
Yeah, hi. It's nice to be back.
So today is our last episode of season two of LSHTM Viral, which has been all about planetary health. So my question to you guys would be, what is the most important thing you think you've learned through this whole season?
That's an interesting question. Aside from like the little snippets of factual information, I think generally what's been quite important is the fact that even though the topic of climate change is sometimes quite daunting to think about and to read about, the researchers, all of the researchers I've spoken to, or most of them, seem passionate and enthusiastic about the road ahead. And actually, the whole idea of working in planetary health is this kind of collaborative effort from everybody.
I think for me, maybe it would be the scope of research that's going on around planetary health and climate change. Because before I started doing this series of the podcast, a lot of what I sort of just assumed in the back of my brain was that people doing this were only sort of involved in temperature change and looking at ice core samples and that sort of thing. But we've had people from pretty much every discipline at LSHTM talking about things to do with planetary health. And I think it's encouraging to see the variety of research going on in it and how they're all interconnected.
I have to agree with you on that point. I think for me, it was just learning about all these areas, because I've done climate change and environmental science for quite a long time and genuinely never thought about human health within that or as part of that, apart from maybe migration issues and that sort of thing. So it's been really cool to find out how many different areas people are looking into. And LSHTM is one of the leaders in this.
In today's episode, Amy and I are speaking to two figures who have helped spearhead the field of planetary health. Sir Andy Haynes, who is a professor of environmental change and public health here at LSHTM, and Richard Horton, who is the editor of the Lancet Journal. First, welcome Andy.
Thanks very much, Naomi. Looking forward to talking through things with you.
So throughout the season, we've been walking through different areas of research in planetary health at LSHTM and outside, but I wanted to go back to the beginning of planetary health as a field. Can you walk us through how it came to be?
Well, planetary health, of course, is a transdisciplinary activity. It has very ancient roots. You could argue that Hippocrates, for example, many people considered to be the father or the grandfather of modern medicine, in his book Airs, Waters, Places, really outlined some of the concepts that underpin planetary health. But in modern times, the term arose in about 2013, 2014, through the Lancet, through Richard, who asked me to chair the Rockefeller Lancet Commission on Planetary Health. And the concept itself really envisaged the integration between human health and environmental sustainability and the multiple environmental trends that are impacting on human society now and will increasingly impact in the future. Obviously, the most important, probably those of us best known, certainly, is climate change, but there are others as well, like the depletion of fresh water, the transformation of land, often to grow food, accompanied by very wide-ranging deforestation, extensive pollution of air, water, and soil, and other changes as well. The planetary health concept really led to proposals for solutions which might help to address these burgeoning challenges, but also help to stabilize the deteriorating environment. And those solutions can be broadly divided into adaptation, how we adapt to the changes that we can't prevent, and mitigation, how do we prevent those changes to which we cannot adapt.
I mean, if we go back now, I think really it's been a growing feeling over the past decade that as we were going through the Millennium Development Goal era, something big was missing.
We also have with us today Richard Horton, who is the editor of The Lancet.
We were taking a very targeted approach to maternal and child health, AIDS, TB and malaria, but we were decontextualizing them from really everything that was in some ways most important. We were taking a very reductive view to health, focusing on particular essential interventions, the building blocks of a health system, but not looking at the wider political, economic, even social determinants of health. And then I think we felt that global health, which had so taken off over the last 20 years, had got itself into a position where, again, it was working in a silo, and public health perhaps even more so, and that we needed to kind of radically reframe our understanding about the meaning of health. You know, I love going to museums, and you look at the ancient civilizations that we have memorialized in our museums, and you realize that there's nothing fixed about our life. Things can change. Civilizations come and then they disappear. And that got me interested into why. Why do civilizations come and why do they go? And in a sense, you could define health not just at the individual level or the community level or the society level, but at the civilizational level. Anyway, as these ideas were brewing, I got talking to Andy about this, and we thought that there was an opportunity to link some of these broader determinants of health to the current agenda. And the idea of planetary health was born, and we were absolutely delighted that the Rockefeller Foundation were willing to invest in that work. And in 2015, out came the commission, and we haven't looked back since.
So, Richard,
what do you think are really the priority areas we need to think about for planetary health right now?
Obviously, a huge component of this is the climate crisis that we're living through. It's very easy, isn't it, how you get knocked off course. And this year, and I mean, I'm just as guilty as this as anybody, you know, my entire life this year and almost the entire life of my colleagues at various Lancet journals has been all about COVID-19. And so there's been this displacement effect. And I think in 2021, especially with the COP agenda for Glasgow, we really need to get back to a more balanced outlook on some of the threats to human health. So that's number one. Let's put the climate issue front and center stage. But also I want to bring, I mentioned this already, biodiversity into our conversation. If you look at the increasing amount of evidence that shows that human systems only thrive when all animal and plant systems are also thriving, and how dependent we are on biodiversity for human health. I don't think that's widely recognized. I think actually this whole idea of the Anthropocene can be somewhat disabling, because the Anthropocene puts us center stage as a species and suggests that we are omnipotent and omnipresent and dominate everything. That's not actually true. Our health depends upon a balance between us and all other species on the planet. And I think we need to decenter ourselves a little bit here and bring in a better understanding of our relationship with other species, both plants and animals. Those are two things I'd like to see. And also, I'm going to push the point about political science a bit more. Everything comes back to politics. And please, let's not forget the politics of this.
Andy, I know policy is an important area in focus within your work as well. So I guess my question for you is, how do we get planetary health onto the political agenda? And not just in terms of climate change policies, but on all political agendas and across different types of policies.
Well, that, of course, is a major challenge, and it won't be easy reorienting the focus of politics. I think we are seeing some sort of green shoots of change. We are seeing a much greater emphasis on the need to rapidly decarbonize the economy. We are seeing some changes, even from conventional economics, reframing to some extent of the economic paradigm. We're seeing growing recognition of the importance of building natural capital, the valuation of natural capital into economic policies, for example. One of the challenges we have is that there are major vested interests, which of course will always oppose change, because at the moment, much of the economic activities in our society depends, of course, on not paying the full economic costs of those activities. So if we drive a fossil fuel-powered car, for example, or we get our domestic heating from fossil fuels, we don't necessarily pay the full economic cost of those. We don't pay the full economic cost of the air pollution or the climate change, particularly when we think about the longer-term impacts. Recasting the economic incentives and levers to ensure that we don't undermine the health of today's and future generations, trying to increase or to improve our economic performance, I think is going to be a really important challenge. But as I say, we are now beginning to witness the beginnings of a sea change, and also perhaps a greater willingness, if one's being optimistic, a greater willingness to tackle some of these vested interests that have driven the economy in the wrong direction. We know that health and the health professionals and the voice of the health professionals and researchers is going to be increasingly important. We've seen that with COVID, that there has been an increasing focus on the voice of the health professions. And we know that many of our colleagues have been working extraordinarily hard and taking major risks with their own health in the face of coronavirus. So this also reminds us that health professionals have a particular role in society and they are trusted voices.
And going back a bit to what Amy asked Richard then, what do you think priority areas for planetary health should be?
So when we think about priorities, we obviously do have to focus our activities to some extent, but we also need to think about the interlinkages between different sectors. In terms of priorities, I suppose we need to think about energy, the demands for energy and how that's driving climate change, energy for economic growth. There have been many calls to question the predominant focus of our societies on increasing GDP. Of course, as we know, GDP is a rather poor indicator of human progress. So in determining priorities, we need to think about those policies, interventions, and technologies which can both protect and promote human health, but also help to stabilize and reverse this environmental degradation. Clearly, the energy sector, power sector is crucial. The built environment, housing, urban planning, the design of cities. Food and agricultural systems are absolutely crucial because the food system is driving much of the biodiversity loss. It's also a very important contributor to climate change. We're also beginning to be aware that the healthcare system itself is an important driver of environmental change. If it was a country, it would be the fifth largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. So thinking across these different sectors, we can identify policies which will give multiple benefits. So one example, of course, would be the acceleration of renewable energy, stopping burning fossil fuels, phasing out fossil fuels over coming years and decades, and moving towards the use of renewable energy, such as solar and wind energy. But there are many others as well, including dietary change, moving towards healthier, lower environmental impact diets. So there are many considerations that we have to bear in mind, not just the development of new technologies and policies, but also very much how we implement them.
And Richard,
I just want to delve back to your point there about the, you know, humans being centre stage and that the idea of that in the Anthropocene. Is there lessons kind of that we can learn, or do you think it's going to be a difficult task for humans to take themselves off the centre stage in a while?
Well, I mean, this is where COVID-19 comes in, I think. You know, we started off the year and we probably all had our plans for the year. And look what happened. We saw that our society is extremely brittle, very fragile, that progress around us is definitely not inevitable. Reversals are possible. Not everything is about going forward. And so COVID-19, it's been like a tornado that's thrown us out of the comfort of our assumptions about the world. And so I think this is a moment to pause and reflect on that. I mean, the way I would put it is that COVID-19 is a bit of a moral provocation. It's held a mirror up to our society, and we've looked in that mirror and seen who we really are. And maybe we shouldn't be quite as confident about who we are as we perhaps have been, and that we should question some of these more fundamental assumptions we have. But to do that requires a set of methodologies and disciplines, scholarly approaches that maybe we haven't been used to because we've taken a very biomedical perspective. And that's certainly true of COVID-19. Look, we're all jumping for joy because we have a vaccine. Well, that's great. But we should be talking about inequalities and social exclusion. And why is it that certain communities in our population have been so badly affected? That's not about a vaccine. It's about the patterns of injustice in our society. Well, that's definitely a central theme in planetary health.
Does that come down to the political agenda that you mentioned? Why are we not talking about these inequalities?
Well, I think it comes down to, and this is where we have to be a bit self-critical, I think it comes down to our own disciplinary boundaries. I mean, let me be the first to confess, you know, the Lancet, anybody who picks up the Lancet will see it as the most establishment biomedical edifice you could possibly find, full of randomized trials about new medicines and so on. And I think we have to think about how we write a different, in a sense, a different epistemological contract with the scientific community so that we can rethink the methods and approaches to some of the biggest questions that we face today. And randomized trials, as good as they are not the solution to everything. So how do we broaden the disciplinary base of health and medicine? How do we welcome in different disciplinary communities? I think that is a really important challenge, because the way we've got it at the moment, we're all living in our silos and it's asphyxiating us. It's stopping us from doing things.
Richard, do you think part of this is in communication as well? So the way we talk about science, the way that people view it, the way we approach science communication, what do you think about that?
Just to come back to this year's experience, we used to publish really just for a very narrow group of academics in the broad field of general medicine. But one thing we've found this year is that we've suddenly discovered a new audience, and it's the public. The public have become an incredible force. They want to dissect every paper we publish. You know, what is the evidence that masks are any use? Is this vaccine actually safe or not? What is the evidence whether 1 meter or 2 meters or however many meters is the right physical distance? And we've seen our papers get critiqued in the most extraordinary way in social media, which has been a good thing, but it's created a different level of engagement with the public. I think science has now, you know, this year it's broken out of its gilded cage and it's become a subject for public and political discussion. Now, that's not always comfortable. And you've seen often scientists put in very uncomfortable positions in interviews in the media. And it's also challenging because you're trying to get across to the public the way science works. Science isn't an event, it's a process, and our understanding changes over time. And that can look as if you've got a series of U-turns and confusion about the evidence, whereas actually we're not doing U-turns and we're not confused. We're just growing our knowledge, and that knowledge changes. But that's a good thing, because I think that we're connecting with the public now much better at the end of 2020 than we did at the beginning of 2020. So that does give us an opportunity to reforge this kind of social contract with the public sphere. If you think about the word culture, we think of culture as going to see a movie or theatre or whatever, but we don't think of science necessarily as part of our culture. We think of it as something that's done in universities or research institutes, but it's not mainstream. And I think that's changed this year in the most radical, incredible way. Science is on the front page of every newspaper, you know, it's top of every website. It's driven public discussion. Maybe it's felt too much sometimes. But science, we've seen this year that science has a cultural presence, has cultural force, and that can only be a good thing.
I suppose the fact that because we're all implicated in the COVID scenario, there is a responsibility and a role for everybody to play. People are taking the initiative to try and find out why we're doing these things and how we should behave and how we should act. And maybe that is something that can be translated into other areas as well.
Yes, and that's right. And it's humanized scientists. I mean, you know, the number of times I've heard an interviewer ask one of your professors at the London School, Graham Medley, you know, what are you doing for Christmas with your family? And he starts talking about his mother and his children. You know, it humanizes science as well. Scientists don't have the answer to everything. They're just human beings like anybody else with their own dilemmas and concerns and so on. And I think this has changed the conversation. Now, what do we do with that is the thing. We've got this different relationship with the public thanks to COVID-19. I hope we can use that in a very positive way. and this is where we come back to planetary health perhaps, where we can pick issues that should be of large public concern and engage the public in a discussion about those issues and try and raise them a bit higher up the political list of priorities. Because, you know, I would dearly love to have issues around planetary health taken more seriously by our mainstream politicians and political parties, and they're sadly not at the moment.
We need to be sharing a number of key messages. One is that we need to identify policies that have multiple benefits. So not just thinking about the benefits to one sector of society or even one particular group in the population, but thinking how we can maximize the benefits across society and achieve multiple policy objectives. We also need to ensure that we think about trade-offs and unintended adverse consequences. And that was brought into sharp relief with the whole Gilets Jaunes episode in France, when President Macron attempted to implement increases in fuel prices, but in doing so, disadvantaged the poor, those people on low incomes. And that was a really powerful lesson, I think, to everyone, to all policymakers and researchers. We need to think through the implications of policies and technologies. I think, thirdly, the importance of countering misinformation or disinformation has become vital. This is true, obviously, with COVID, where we've seen vast amounts of both misinformation and active disinformation about COVID. And that's going to be, obviously, very important in pursuing planetary health. So establishing credible sources of evidence, and I think that means being very clear about the limitations of the evidence that we have, where that evidence comes from, what criteria have we used in order to assess the quality of the evidence, and how do we adjust knowledge in the light of emerging evidence, because evidence doesn't just stay static. I think there's a great opportunity to bring the public along with us, to work in areas like citizen science, for example, to improve critical appraisal by the public, to ensure that in education at all levels, people are equipped with basic tools to try to understand whether the evidence they're being presented with is likely to be credible or not. I do believe that the importance of public engagement is really paramount at the moment. Also, the potential to engage the health professions as really important intermediaries, as voices that can help to translate policies in ways that are acceptable to the public. But I think we're all aware that this is a period of considerable peril and uncertainty, but at the same time, it's also a period of great opportunity. And if we can grasp that opportunity, then I think we can really argue for transformational policies over coming years and decades, which can really set humanity on a different course.
So the underlying theme about what we're doing with the podcast and what the field of planetary health and planetary health researchers are doing is ultimately about hope. And we've been asking all the researchers this question. So when it comes to our future, are you hopeful?
In a sense, I see myself as relatively neutral in that respect. And as much as I see there's enormous grounds for concern, I do think we have many of the tools that we need to transform prospects of humanity in the future. Whether we can implement those in the speed that's required, of course, we don't know at present. But I do take great heart, actually, from the changes we've seen even in recent months, and the increased urgency with which decision makers have embraced some of the challenges. Of course, we still don't know whether they will implement policies at the necessary pace and scale. But I think there are real grounds for optimism because of some of the changes in recent months. I do think there are new opportunities opening up for researchers who want to embark on a career in this broad field of planetary health. I think that there are grounds for cautious optimism and indeed hope. We don't have the luxury really of failure. So we don't have the luxury of pessimism. We have to move forward, really embarking on knowledge generation, but also implementation, working with a broad coalition of policymakers and the broader public in order to try to transform societies into more resilient, but also much lower environmental impact societies for the future. So yes, let's move forward with feelings of shared optimism, not naivete. Of course, there'll be major challenges as we move forward. But there are, I think, cautious grounds for optimism at the moment.
And what about you, Richard? Do you have hope? Are you hopeful for the future?
I do. I feel very hopeful about the future. And I feel hopeful about the future because of the next generation. I have a 20-year-old daughter, and I see her and her friends and what they think about the world and how they talk about the world. And watching them and listening to them talk, I feel super optimistic about the future. There's a passion and almost a rage about the direction of travel of the world that I really feel there's an energized generation out there who are not going to let us get away with what we've got away with so far. I don't think it's my generation. I think it's the next generation.
Well, thank you, Richard and Andy, for your time today. Listeners, stay tuned for our next season, which will deep dive into vaccines from their development to rollout. Thank you for listening, and a big thanks to my two co-hosts, Amy and Carl.
Thanks, Amy. And yeah, big thank you to everyone I've spoken to on the podcast. And thank you to everybody who's listened to the episodes and, you know, given us feedback or rated us or given us a review or taken an interest in what we're doing. So yeah, thanks. And we'll see you in the next season.
Yeah, huge thank you to both of you for being wonderful co-hosts. Big thanks to everyone who I've spoken to this year. They've not only been amazing guests, but they've taught me so much. And a huge thanks to everyone who's listened, just to sort of reiterate what Amy said there. It's been great hearing people who've enjoyed the podcast telling us what they thought. And we'd love to hear more about it as well. You know, if people want to hear us talk about certain things in the future or talk about less things in the future, maybe they've heard enough about cow burps so far, I'm not sure.